I'm sat here with Dave Archer, Savannah Resources, ticker on the AIM market, SAV. Dave, hello.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This will be a bit different to what you're used to. All these questions have been submitted through direct messages, emails, on the London South East bulletin board. So all these questions are from your shareholders. So nothing to do with us whatsoever. We're just the messenger. Yesterday, your RNS announcement was Oman Copper Gold project update. Can you explain what this means to the company and the shareholder value, please?
Sure. Well, I think it was certainly an update of most of the drilling that we did in the second half of calendar 2015. And I think what it did is it really consolidated all of the drilling results in a way that I hope was relatively comprehensible. And I suppose what it did show is that, for example, with Kadama, that we've increased the length and mineralised envelope at Kadama, which is the high-grade gold deposit on Block 4. We're sort of very pleased with the results are continuing to be encouraging there. So that project is looking pretty interesting. On the copper side, we announced the results of some of the drilling that we'd been able to do at Mahab. And Mahab is probably the highest grade of the four deposits that we'll be sort of concentrating on. I think we've got around about 1.5 million tonnes at about 2.4% copper. And the drilling we've done has both confirmed the high-grade mineralisation that was originally identified. There was something like 56 metres at 6% copper, something of that order. We had an equivalently high-grade intersection last year. And then one of the last results was a lower-grade result, but demonstrated that sort of the high-grade material sits within a more disseminated, lower-grade copper envelope. And what we're actually seeing here is that you've got a very high-grade copper stack at the top. This is where the black smoker has emitted the fluids, the metal-rich fluids. They've settled down into a very rich stack. And this was fed through a feeder system. And what we did was we actually ended up drilling into that feeder system and demonstrating that there's some quite useful, relatively lower grades, but nevertheless very useful grades of copper below that very high grade stack. So effectively what we're doing is broadening and increasing the size of the overall sort of mineralised envelope at Mahab. And Mahab will be one of the very sort of key deposits in terms of our mine development plans, because it's the most high grade of the four deposits. The second major element that sort of came through as a result of the announcement was that we defined further mineralisation in the envelope around the old La Salle mine. La Salle historically has been the biggest producer of copper in Oman, and we believe that it hosts a very, very large copper system. We've been analysing a lot of the old drill data, and we've identified, as we announced on Monday, two further zones of surface mineralisation, which are characterised by, again, quite high grades, and then a third zone at depth with also very, very high grades. So we're very pleased about what we're seeing there at La Salle. And it's certainly got the potential to be the largest of the deposits in terms of volume. And I think with our exploration target, we were sort of talking about an overall range of 10 to 29 million tonnes for the four deposits in aggregate. And probably the largest deposit tonnage was actually associated with La Salle. So, in broad terms, making very good progress with Kadama and La Salle. And finally, as well, late last year, we also announce that we got some very good results on the Arja deposit as well. This is underground material, but very sort of useful lengths and grades of copper mineralization. And interestingly enough, with good zinc grades and some very interesting gold as well. The thing about gold is that in terms of the historical drill data set, there was limited to no analysis and assay for gold. So we think there's a real possibility of there being a quite valuable gold byproduct associated, particularly with the Arja copper mineralisation.
Oh, so,
So sort of quite
interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, quite an interesting sort of element. So in our overall exploration target, I think we were looking at an average grade of around about, or a highish grade of around about 0.4 grams per tonne, which would be very, very sort of useful.
So yeah, it would be really nice actually, man. Yeah, wouldn't it?
So building a really very sort of solid copper story with a very interesting gold bonus associated with it.
All right. That's the beauty, you see. You put an RNS out yesterday and people read it and the way the markets are. But you get to talk to somebody like yourself, then people will watch this and they'll think, all right, that's what the RNS. I know some people don't get them, you know. They read them, but they don't get them. But it's nice to talk to you just to get a bit of clarification. So to pick up on that one, last week's RNS, can I touch on that with your investor? Because that was a very upbeat RNS, that.
Yeah, obviously very encouraged, and we're delighted to see our margin very seriously increasing its investment in the company.
29% or something.
Yep, 29.9% shareholding stake that they're taking. They'll be the largest shareholder in the company, and they're very supportive of our investment approach. Are very keen to sort of support our copper mine development initiative in Oman, and I think it's really very key having a very good register. I think that's a very much a distinguishing feature of Savannah, both as a result of the investment of Al Margin, which is a very sticky investment. They're committed for the long haul. That's supplemented by, of course, my own shareholding and that of Dale Ferguson and the rest of the team. We have our own money on the line, and so very sort of committed to delivering a good outcome both for our shareholders and ourselves, with the share price going up. And finally, we've got a very strong shareholder support from a very loyal group of private investors.
You're very popular out there, actually. I know I shouldn't say that on camera. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Yes.
But I look across social media and I watch what goes on, and it says you are definitely on the radar. That's for sure what I would say.
Yeah, we're very keen on sort of reaching out, as they say these days, to our investors, and we sort of maintain a very sort of close dialogue with our shareholders, and try to have a very sort of active program of engagement via social media as much as one can, with both, particularly with Twitter.
So the next, just to finish off on that one, obviously we were talking about the investment there, and one of the questions is, are they happy to fund a company working in Mozambique, or will SAV be looking to spin the Moz and Oman assets into different companies?
Well, certainly Al Margin are very interested in Mozambique. They sort of recognise the potential there, and of course it's a world-class mineral sands province there on the coast of Mozambique, and Rio Tinto has defined a very large deposit with an exploration target, I think it's between 7 and 12 billion tonnes of heavy minerals. So that's a lot of mineralisation.
Staggering.
So Al Margin certainly identified the appeal from their point of view of Mozambique, and certainly very supportive of that initiative on our part, and of course just waiting for government approvals there. In terms of their long-term position, they're certainly very solidly in there at 29%. I think that they're keen on nurturing the company, nurturing the management team. They believe that we've got the skill set and the drive and the capability of delivering the outcomes that we've enunciated.
Yeah, it's definitely it was a good RNS. Are you happy with the current shareholder register, and what is your estimated free float of shares to the public?
Please? Well, I think in terms of a free float, I think when you add up both our margin shareholding, that of two or three of the larger private investors, and of course the executive staff as well, I think you're sort of talking about 35 to 40%. At least with that very sort of simple arithmetic, and having regard to probably sort of a few other shareholders with a long-term commitment, I think you'd have to sort of say at least 50% of the free float is not going to see the light of day, which sort of dramatically sort of limits the number of shares that you might see on the market. So I don't want to limit it too much, and I think one of the great things about Savannah is that it enjoys very good liquidity. This is not a stock where you trade by invitation only. We customarily trade many millions of shares per day, and I think that's another very good reason for investment in the company. If you want to buy, well, you can buy. If you want to sell, well, you can sell. We're very supportive of that degree of liquidity.
Okay, that's great. After the recent funding announcements to Cornerstone Local Marnie Investor Fund, do you foresee any future dilutive fundraising required before project finance, assuming all goes to plan?
Well, we should be pretty all right with the current level of funding for the rest of this year. So clearly there are further capital requirements in terms of taking Oman forward into production, but there are a number of streams of finance that would be available to fund that, everything from private equity, and they're literally billions of dollars on the sidelines in specialist resource investment funds or private equity funds looking for good destinations to invest their money. So we have been and will continue to talk to some of those funds. There's a recently established specialist resources fund in Oman as well, which is called Mineral Development Oman, which has been put together by four of the major sovereign wealth funds in Oman. The MDO is specifically mandated to invest in Omani projects. So they're another potential source for sort of follow-on investment and follow-on financing. And of course, then there's sort of conventional specialist resource project finance. I've had very good relationships with a number of specialist project finance banks in the resources sector, so I would imagine that some amount of funding would be available from them. And then, of course, there's very sort of conventional lease financing of equipment, a little bit like getting lease finance to buy your car. So the Caterpillars of this world, from whom you might be buying mobile equipment like bulldozers, front-end loaders, things of that sort, there's a lot of finance available to fund the acquisition of those mobile fleets. So, whilst the equity market clearly is somewhat subdued at the moment, there are other sources of capital which we believe will provide us with the ability to take these projects forward into development in a well-funded way.
But I've got to ask this question. I've spoken to a couple of companies over the last month, mining companies.
Yes.
And the cycle seems to be changing for the mining companies. It seems to be turning. If you look at the price of gold in Australia, I don't know if it's too soon. But what's your opinion on that at the moment today? The cycle. Do you think we're near the bottom, or do you think it's going to the upturn's coming? Or Do you have any views on that?
Yeah, well, you know, when you think the peak of the cycle was 2010, 2011, yeah. We're 2016 now, so we're effectively 5 years into sort of the down part of the cycle. We're certainly getting closer to the end of the down down part of it all. And generally, the commodity price cycles have quite a very broad in amplitude. So it's probably another 2 or 3 years, I would have thought, before things start clearly moving out into a much more sort of buoyant pricing environment. But I suppose what we're doing is designed to deliberately sort of coincide with what we believe will be an uptick in the
price cycle. That's what I was driving at, yeah.
Yeah, there's no point in making a decision to develop a mine in 2020 and take another 3 years or so to, or 4 years or whatever it is, to bring it into production.
Yeah.
You know, the cycle,
it's passed you by.
Might have passed you by. Yeah. I think, the time to make decisions to develop mines is at the bottom of the cycle where we are at the moment, so that you can actually present new mines, new producing mines, at the initial part of the uptick of the mining cycle, enjoy the benefits of producing copper and getting a higher and higher price each month.
Yeah. What is your personal target in terms of share price for SAV at the end game? Now, that's a loaded question, I know it is.
Well, that's a very, very different. Well, I think in broad terms, a whole lot more than what it is at the moment, I'd hope. But it's pretty tough to be sort of drawn on prices. You have to be pretty sort of careful.
Mystic Meg.
Yeah. Hopefully a better price is probably my answer.
You're going to love this next question. Is SAV your retirement share?
Well, it certainly takes virtually all of my attention and time, both conscious and unconscious time. So from that point of view, yeah, I'd say that it's something I'd really like to see form a more significant part of my overall portfolio.
And, well, you've invested in it. So
I've invested in it, and I've committed my time and reputation to it. So, it's front and centre, pretty important.
Right, the next one. Can you go into some detail on how you've done this kind of project before, brackets, i.e. turning small companies to big ones, close brackets, and do you believe SAV will do a similar thing or better?
Yeah, well, certainly. I've been involved with public companies for a number of decades, and I'm pleased to report that I've had at least three major successes in terms of taking the company from a relatively small start through to being quite material and quite sort of significant. Firstly, with Savage Resources in Australia, took it from being a mining minnow in 1987 and eventually developed into a company with market capitalization, I think around about $400 or $500 million dollars in Australia in the mid-1990s, which meant it was a very significant mid-tier mining company. Did it again in the telecommunications space in the late 1990s, and more recently with Hillgrove Resources in Australia. Again, very modestly capitalised company. In fact, took it out of administration, recapitalised it, and by the time I got it all sort of sorted out, I think it had a market capitalisation when I left of about $250 million, and was dividend paying and in pretty good shape. So, yes,
I think that answers that question.
I've been there and done that.
Got the T-shirt.
Hopefully, four times lucky with Savannah.
Next one, please. There is talk of splitting the company into two to make each asset more attractive to different investors, only wanting exposure to one asset. Does the recent fundraising hint that the split is likely and would leave both companies with enough capital to progress to production?
Yeah,
I don't ask these questions.
Yeah, well, it's a tough question. I suppose the answer really is the board of Savannah will really do what it believes is in the best interests of shareholders. If If splitting the company, you turn one and one into three, well, you know, we'll certainly do that. And there's a real possibility that that would, you know, provide
because you're diverse, aren't you?
Yeah, more visibility, more focus on a copper asset in one company and a mineral sands asset in another company. So it may well be that, you know, that is the sort of the best course of action. My sense is, though, that we're probably not quite ready for that as yet. I think there's still a lot more sort of polishing of the apple that's required, both with the copper and the mineral sands, you know, to really sort of present the underlying investment appeal. But it's certainly something that you know, we have actively considered, and you know, we'll actively continue to consider that as a potential value-adding opportunity for our shareholders.
Okay, that's great. Why is a mining merger allowing an AIM mineral develop and share a tier one asset?
Really, it's quite straightforward, isn't it? Yeah, it's a good question, and certainly, I think the major reason is that Rio Tinto has very publicly announced a capital expenditure moratorium. They're not putting in any money into developing new projects. They're very much sticking to their knitting, particularly on the iron ore side and copper. So it was a very deliberate decision on the part of Rio Tinto to look at how it might be able to sort of maximise the value of existing investments, and they felt that one way of doing that in the case of the Matamba deposit was to team with a smaller company like ourselves, who might be able to bring Matamba into production in the short term with a rather more sort of modest level of sort of capital expenditure, whilst Rio at the same time maintains a very significant economic interest in the project, and of course will be taking 100% of the offtake. So I think it ticks a lot of boxes for Rio Tinto, and at the same time it's a very useful alignment from our point of view, and gives us an opportunity to take, you know, what is a very exciting project forward into production.
Definitely, it's just to say Rio Tinto on yourself, it just sounds, it has a good ring to it.
Yeah.
How much due diligence did Rio have to do on you and your team before signing off on the venture for SAV to earn up to 51% of the Tier 1 asset?
Yeah, well, it was quite extensive on their part. We had negotiations and discussions over almost 2 years, so we got to know each other very well as a result of that. So formed very effective working relationships with the Rio Tinto people, and of course there was very extensive due diligence undertaken by Rio Tinto on ourselves and ditto on our part with the Matamba assets. So both of us have got a very good understanding of the counterparty and of the asset.
All right, that's great. How much work gone on in Moz that is waiting on the JV sign-off to be released, i.e. initial JORC or scoping study?
Yeah, well, we've certainly done some amount of work in the background. We're still waiting for the final sign-off from the Mozambican government, but we've been doing continued desktop studies in the background, so that when we do get the approval, we'll be able to hit the ground running and move straight into further resource evaluations with drilling, and move pretty quickly into launching an initial scoping study that will really help sort of define the financial sort of framework and how this thing might roll out.
Oh, that's great. How big is the Moz Heavy Metal Sands project? It looks to be a T1 asset. Is a comparable asset elsewhere you can compare it with, please?
It's
a loaded question.
Yeah, well, you know, certainly the East Coast of Africa supports a number of major heavy mineral sands accumulations, both south of us with the old Corridor Sands project, and further to the north, Kenmare's, and of course base's operations north of Mozambique. So the Matamba deposit really sort of sits pretty sort of comfortably within that sort of range.
That's great. Yeah,
yeah, it's a very, I suppose what we have at Matamba is relatively characteristic of other large mineral sands deposits along the east coast of Mozambique, particularly being ilmenite dominant.
So it looks quite a good play then, really.
Yeah, and again, yeah, like all of these commodities, I think we've sort of seen mineral sands go into a down phase. I think mineral sands went into a price reduction phase a little bit earlier than, say, oil or the base metals, and I'd sort of think that we've already sort of seen a supply response in relation to that, and I think mineral sands will probably come out the other end a little bit more quickly than, say, the iron ores or coals.
So, yeah.
And you know, my experience, having observed mineral sands prices over a number of decades, is that whilst they can track pretty low, they can also track really very high. And if you get your timing right and you're producing at that time when mineral sands prices are at near record highs, there's just the cash generative ability of these projects is really quite enormous.
I think that's just the thing with yourself as well, because of your industry experience over all the decades.
Mm-hmm.
You've actually, this is your life, so
yes,
to speak.
Yeah.
So what you're saying there makes perfect sense, because you've studied these markets, you're doing this business.
Mm-hmm.
So I just thought, well, it just isn't it? It's crazy. Like, you know, you meet some other companies and they're doing other stuff, but you guys, especially yourself,
yes,
for your CV.
Yes.
You know, it's your industry. You know it. You know
the
industry.
Been doing it for a few years.
Yeah, so you've got a little bit of experience. The capital startup cost for Moz has been speculated to be quite low. Can you give an estimate on this cost?
Probably not.
Are you allowed to?
It's still early days.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we'll have to wait for the scoping
right
study to come out there. But we hope that it would be on the sort of low end of capital costs for a mine development of this sort.
Okay.
So, yeah, it'll be modest in scale and,
right,
and modest in terms of costs, but hopefully we'll be producing a sort of, or sorry, we'll be mining high-grade material, and it'll have very good economic outcomes.
All right. Rio have agreed to acquire 100% of the production from the mines. Is this at the then market rate or an already agreed rate?
We've got an already agreed rate, and that sort of basically relates to market prices on the day.
Right, you've only got four more to go. I couldn't take any more questions.
Okay.
I got that many, I was like, right, you'd be here all day. How much do you estimate was spent by Rio on their exploration that we have been given technically for nothing?
Certainly there's an enormous sort of legacy database of drill data, metallurgical test work data, some baseline data that's been done sort of generally on things like port facilities, capacities, water, power, all of those sorts of things. So haven't really put a number on it.
Infrastructure, so to speak, around,
yeah.
Yeah.
But
sure.
There's certainly been a very significant investment by Rio Tinto over time, and much of that information is available to us, and that information allows us to, if you like, sort of fast track our economic assessment and perhaps pull together a...
It's a good position to be in, actually.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a very good position.
And, it's a consistent theme that runs through both our Oman and Mozambique assets. We're looking to work off very large legacy databases that both save us a lot of time. It might take 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years to undertake an equivalent level of drilling. So it both saves time and also, of course, it saves a lot of money having to...
Definitely, yeah.
Obviates the need to do that. So,
excuse me.
So, yeah, that's a common theme. And I think the other common theme between both of these projects is that they both sit within settings which are relatively well served in terms of infrastructure,
mm-hmm,
particularly so in Oman, being 30 or so kilometres from the export port of Sohar. literally power lines going overhead, a very able local workforce. And in the case of Mozambique, being not that far from the port of Inhambane, which has the potential to be a very sort of useful export port for the heavy mineral concentrates. Nearby power, the good EN1, which is the major national highway that runs north-south in Mozambique, runs right through our tenement area, and good local communities that could provide the workforce for mine development. So, we won't be putting in an enormous amount of infrastructure to get these projects going, and that will help to reduce the overall sort of sunk cost and enhance the overall economic returns.
No, thanks very much. That's great. Mm-hmm. How much money did the legacy database of drill holes in Oman save, and how many years did it save?
Similar sort of thing, but probably tens of millions of dollars, and quite a two, three, four, 5 years worth of work.
Yeah, unbelievable. Oman again, sorry. Yes. Oman is a British outpost. Do you have any ex-British politicians on your directors board?
No, we don't. But we've got very good relationships in country. We maintain a close liaison with the British Embassy in Muscat, and I've been going to Oman for about 5 years or so. So sort of generally know the way the place operates, and generally know who's who. There and we're very comfortable with the sort of country setting and the risk setting in that country. But I think one of the key advantages we do have is that we're a British company, and the UK and Oman have a very effective and cordial and long-term relationship. So I think that can only help our company, and we're very sort of keen on contributing to Oman, both with investment and jobs, and we think in our own small way that will sort of really help to further facilitate the relationship between the United Kingdom and the Sultanate.
Right, thank you. Second last one. Some would say that now very healthy sum caches that SAV has is more than enough to get each project to a point we can look at project financing. Is there something else in the pipeline that this money is earmarked for?
No, it's really pretty much exclusively for Mozambique and Oman, and we'll certainly employ it very sort of cautiously. And really try and generate as much value and as much of a value multiplier out of every pound that we deploy. Although I must admit we've converted a lot of it already to US dollars.
All right.
Which ended up probably being a relatively wise decision in regard to the performance of the British pound in the last few days.
I won't digress about the euro, but that's another story. The final question, and by the way, thanks very much, David, for taking your time out today. It's been much appreciated, and I'm sure when people watch the video, your answers, they're very, very honest and helpful.
Thank you.
Right, Sav, what are your short-term aims to attract new investors? Your short-term aims.
Well,
another PR spin, please.
Yeah, I suppose really getting out there and telling people what we're about. I think what we're doing in Oman makes enormous sense. There are not that many companies with a project like this, with the sort of the capital expenditure characteristics that it has and the high-grade nature of it. So, I think it provides a compelling investment opportunity. For investors, I'm very keen to get out there and tell people about it because I think it's a good news story. And ditto.
You're talking to us today.
It's very well supported by the Mozambique story as well, which I think has enormous potential. So, I think what we've got has a lot of merit. So I think enunciating that story, I think, will be very sort of key from the value proposition point of view. And of course, you know, we're going to maintain quite a high tempo of activity, specifically in Oman. I think there'll be a number of milestone achievements over time, basically outlining or increasing the mineral resource for Oman. We'll probably be looking at providing more definition around the financial metrics of the mine development, applying for mining leases, and sort of keeping the market informed as to how all of that is actually sort of progressing along. So a lot of milestone features, I think, that we'll be able to point to over the course of the rest of the year. And of course, Mozambique sliding in, hopefully in coming months, on the back of Mozambican government approval.
No, that's great. And by the way, truly, thanks very much for your time, because we get sent questions all the time, but you had a lot of questions, and I know people are watching this and they'll know the questions they submitted today, but I couldn't put them all in because I've took over half an hour of your time.
Oh, that's okay.
Don't worry. So I apologise to the viewers whose questions aren't in there, but like I said, all these are genuine questions from people, so they'll be really happy in there. Thanks very much for your time. You're a gentleman.
Yeah, thank you. Alex.
Thanks very much.